This call is being recorded.
This is Shira Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and we have three people today who will be discussing community choice aggregation options. They're talking for a short time here, and then we'll open it up to discussions from the members of the group. So Roger Wilkins from Athens Energy Institute in Ohio will be talking first, and Matthew Marshall from Redwood Coast Energy Authority will be talking second, and then Samuel Golding with Community Choice Partners out in California will be the third presenter. So Roger, why don't you go ahead and start us out here.
Okay, I'm going to give you a brief overview of what's happening with community choice aggregation here in Ohio. And I must tell you, things are in turmoil. Three years ago, I helped start the Southeast Ohio Public Energy Council, a council of governments, which is a community choice aggregator in Southeast Ohio, and served as executive director for the first year of that. I've stepped down, but keep in close touch. And SOPEC, as we call ourselves, is in an expansion mode. We're adding neighboring counties and municipalities and trying to grow that organization. At the same time, our big brother, big sister, NOPEC, Northeast Ohio Public Energy Council, which I think is the biggest and maybe the longest lasting community choice aggregator in the country, and it really dominates Northeast Ohio. It has had a real blow up with its primary supplier, First Energy. And so they are searching for new suppliers. They have a whole list, but they're in turmoil. And behind this is the continuing threat by both First Energy and AEP Ohio, the other large utility, to press the legislature to re-regulate the industry, which of course would totally undercut community choice aggregation. And in Ohio, the utilities have a great deal of influence, both with our Public Utility Commission and with the legislature. So there is a very real possibility that we will get re-regulated. And a major aspect of what I'm doing with the Athens Energy Institute is looking for options that I might suggest to our Council of Governments in the event that we get re-regulated. So that's sort of the situation we're in here in Ohio.
Okay, Matthew, do you want to give a brief rundown of what's going on over in Redwood Coast Energy Authority?
Yeah, just a little background on our organization. We're a local government joint powers agency of the County of Humboldt and all the incorporated cities in Humboldt County. We've been around since 2003, and historically we've focused primarily on energy efficiency programs. So we partner with our local utility on implementing commercial, residential, and municipal energy efficiency rebate programs and technical assistance. And, you know, growing out of that sort of origin in energy efficiency, you know, we a few years back began looking at renewable energy resource planning and development opportunities in the county, and, you know, considering, you know, how could we start moving the dial on developing local renewable resources, and that really sort of led into launching a community choice aggregation program to pursue those objectives. And so we're in the sort of launch phase. We're on track to begin service to customers in May of 2017. And so we'll be doing our initial rate setting coming here in January, and then kind of beginning with the launch of the program. As far as kind of the structure of it, you know, we kind of, I think, are doing two things a bit differently than the sort of standard California approach to launching a community choice aggregation program. And the first one is we didn't have any money to get it up and running, and so we structured our sort of technical services approach to basically require providers as far as on the back office side of things and all the technical assistance to basically kind of work at risk through the sort of technical analysis and launch phases, and then basically recoup that amortized over the first 4 years of operation. And so we kind of did a request for proposals to meet all of our various sort of operational service needs with that structure, and we were successful in doing that. And I think the other thing that came out of that process that's a little bit different is our approach to procurement is a little bit more structured, similar to how a lot of small municipal utilities buy their power, and that's that we're working with a power marketer procurement agency called TEA, and there's other similar organizations. So they'll actually be kind of transacting in the market on our behalf and using their master service agreements, which is a little bit different than sort of the standard approach, which has been sort of a full requirements approach where you say, hey, give us bids, and then they have starting out with just one or two sort of counterparties for their power portfolio. We'll be able to kind of tap into TEA's existing relationships, which I think they have agreements with basically all of the folks that are engaged in the California market, and so we'll be able to use their master agreements to have a little bit more dynamic and transparent process for procurement. That's a little bit different than where the sort of typical model has started out. And so it's interesting because often people will refer to it as being sort of we're outsourcing it to TEA, but we actually have I would say to some extent a much more hands-on approach and a lot more transparency into what we're actually paying for various power products as far as resource adequacy and how we're able to manage the portfolio in a little bit more of a transparent and dynamic way. So, well, the proof will be in the pudding, of course, of how that works out. But so far we're on track and excited to kind of begin the launch process and see how things play out.
All right. Samuel, do you want to go ahead and take over here? And Samuel's involved with a lot of community choice aggregation programs since the beginning of time, so he's got quite a rendition here. Go ahead, Samuel.
Thank you. So as Roger and Matthew have demonstrated, community choice is one name with many different meanings. And to a large extent, that depends where you are in the country and on local political design goals for the program. So there's probably over 1,200 community choice programs across 6 states. And almost all of them are fairly simple. They hire a single ESP or power marketer under a short-term contract to give them a fairly basic hedged rate that usually starts off at least underneath the bundled service rate. California took a fairly different approach, and that was motivated by political preferences. Californians, or at least the groups involved in community choice, weren't prioritizing rate decreases as a design goal of the programs. Instead, they were prioritizing the development of new and preferably local renewables, as well as distributed energy resources. So the contracting, the financing and contracting process for those programs is much more complex, and they end up looking kind of like municipal utilities without a distribution grid. So they're typically groups of municipal governments that form an agency with their own governing board and charter and staff, and then they hire multiple subcontractors, legal expertise, accounting expertise, financial expertise, technical consultants, and then operational service providers for data management, call center services, power procurement services. And so we're the community choice programs in California are really shaping the trajectory of power planning and operations to a certain extent. They're producing multi-decade integrated resource plans, and they are accruing multi-million dollar reserve funds so that they are stable through those time periods. And that's allowing them to construct new renewables and distributed energy resources. So I can just run down a list of some concrete examples. Sonoma Clean Power launched 2 years ago. They increased renewables from 33% to 33% from 20%, slashed greenhouse gas emissions by a third, decreased rates by 5 to 8%, depending on the rate class. And then they ended up, on top of all that, paying off their startup loans of $7 million in the first year. And by the end of year two, had accrued $30 million in a reserve fund. Customers in that territory have saved nearly $70 million. They've contracted for 70 megawatts of new solar, 40 megawatts of repowered wind. They signed a 10-year contract for existing geothermal. Looking around, Marin has also been allocated WAPA hydropower. Almost all programs have some sort of FIT or NEM to support tariff to support distributed energy. But beyond that, they're also really starting to open up the hood on how to integrate distributed energy with the functionality of a load serving entity. So like Lancaster is replacing its municipal bus fleet with electric buses and managing those charging schedules. Both Sonoma and Marin are deploying electric vehicle managed charging programs through eMotor Works. And Marin, I think, is the furthest along in terms of integrating distributed energy. They do run efficiency programs and have been attempting to expand on-bill financing. They're piloting demand response with Schneider Electric and Nest. They have an energy storage microgrid pilot with Tesla, and they are deploying a fairly innovative approach to potentially automating EM and V for distributed energy across their entire customer portfolio using their access to smart meter data. So that's, I think that's a good general overview of the range of different program designs and their impacts. Roger was noting, in Ohio, where they're using, they're relying on a single ESP, NOPEC is in danger of having to suspend their aggregation if they don't find an alternate supplier, because First Energy is potentially exiting the market or reneging on their contract. And that's one of the risks we find. That's actually the second time that NOPEC has nearly failed from that counterparty risk. The first was in their early years of the aggregation when they hired Green Mountain Energy, who then had to subsequently exit the Ohio market because of regulatory changes in a different state. And they were able to find another primary supplier and carry on. But if you don't, what we've found across all these states is that if you don't collect a reserve fund, and if you don't diversify your portfolio and engage in active risk management, then you're at the mercy of the markets. And oftentimes, CCAs will just suspend operations. So for example, the city of Chicago, the largest CCA in the country, had to suspend operations. All throughout Illinois, CCAs have been suspending operations for the last few years. And that really precludes the ability to engage in long-term planning or contracting.
Okay. And Samuel will be the presenter on the next webinar in January, which I'll have that information out in a little while here. So anybody have any questions? I'm sure you do. anybody, including the panel here, can please just go ahead and dive in. And please introduce yourself when you ask the question. There, I see that you're there. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
This is Evan Hughes. Well,
Roger here. Reflecting on some of the things Samuel has said and how it bears on our experience here in Ohio, we started out trying to, as a pretty small entity, put out an ambitious RFP that included energy efficiency programming and creating our own at least 3 megawatt solar installation. And we contracted both with an energy supplier, one of our utilities, a for-profit arm of AEP, which is called AEP Energy, for our basic energy supply, and at the time got a very good rate. And we contracted with a second entity called Empower Gas and Electric, which has grown up in Ohio, mainly out of Columbus, over the past 3 or 4 years to do energy efficiency and help us establish our small solar farm. What we found was that we're now in the second year, coming to the end of the second year of a 3-year contract, that the basic energy supplier, AEP Energy, was able first to get the regulations changed so that our contract was only for generation. It had started out as generation plus distribution, or plus transmission, I'm sorry. So it cut down the portion of the bill that we were dealing with. And then they've successfully transferred a lot of their cost structure away from generation into distribution, particularly, so that in recent months, they've been able to undercut the price that we were buying at. So there's some renegotiating and positioning going on, but we found, in my view, and as I said, I'm no longer on the staff of SOPEC, that we were in a very vulnerable position. And I think that harkens to some of what Samuel is saying. The other thing is we found it very difficult to get the amount of assistance we were looking for in establishing our own solar farm. And so that hasn't come into being. However, we did start our own energy efficiency group called First Upgrade Athens County. And now it's become a nonprofit organization, Upgrade Ohio. And I work closely with that organization, and we're doing a variety of things, including, I think, we're going to be able to do a very good community solar project, basically putting solar installations on schools in our area and facilitating community ownership of those. But it's been quite a difficult task, I think, partly because we were so reliant on the single energy supplier, and partly because of the economic and political power that they wield. So for a relatively small startup organization, it's been quite challenging.
Kevin, you had a question there. Do you want to go ahead?
Yes, I wanted to ask if anyone has experience with what in California, or what on my PG&E bill is called an indifference charge, which I think is $5 or $4.50 versus the charge to the CCA. This is the San Mateo County in California CCA, Peninsula Clean Energy. And yes, the...
Yeah, I was...
Yeah, the charge is about $22 for the CCA and about $4.50 for this indifference charge.
This is Samuel. I spend a lot of time on those regulations. In fact, there's a workshop for the indifference charges tomorrow in Oakland. They came about when the California market was being restructured as a non-bypassable charge mechanism to recoup any sort of above market costs. Sorry, there's an echo. Could someone go on mute that just joined?
Yeah, somebody needs to mute their phone here, please. Thank you. I think we're
good. Okay, so it's great. It started off as a non-bypassable charge during restructuring so that the utilities could recoup their above market costs of generation and capacity. And subsequently was, after the restructuring was suspended after the energy crisis, and we never got a forward capacity market, and the utilities became the de facto parties to conduct power planning and origination activities. Those non-bypassable charges were expanded to cover new generation, including the renewable portfolio standard contracts, which in the early years of the RPS were fairly costly. So now that we have community choice programs starting up, this is becoming an issue. Cost recovery for various legacy contracts, RPS contracts, how the calculation is performed, are all fairly opaque and contentious. On top of that, there are some broader issues associated with the expansion of CCA authorities and how the utilities are conducting power planning. So, you know, the utilities maintain portfolios, they own generation, they have engaged in PPAs for quite a lot of the power supply in California. And at a high level, our state might transition 50 to 70% of its load to CCA service over the next few years. And at a certain point, community choice programs that are starting up or enrolling subsequent phases of customers are going to find it increasingly difficult and then impossible to contract ahead of time for power without contracting with utilities and unbundling their portfolios, which imposes all sorts of kind of transparency and regulation and quite frankly, issues of equity. I think that's a good overview of where we're at.
I had a question on the dollar amount. As I recall, the utilities came into the PUC with a charge on this item that might have been more like $15 a month for me, which is actually more like $4 or $5. Can you give me any history on what happened on that in California?
Well, the indifference charge is currently calculated as the difference between the utility's total portfolio cost and the market rate, both of which are forecasts and kind of synthetic estimates. So the indifference charge, which is set annually as part of the utility energy resource recovery account proceedings, fluctuates
that
with the market
PUC.
Price. Yes, all through the PUC. The PUC doesn't have the staff or the capabilities or the desire to, in my opinion, effectively regulate those calculations or the process. So it's basically what the utilities propose and how they explain it. And then that's what sets the rate. There is a general fear, I will say, that the PCIA is actually lower than it arguably, from the utility's perspective, should be, because the way that the market price is calculated is in part based on EIA surveys of renewable power prices for the Western region. And the utilities are indicating that that's actually lower than or higher than what they're able to sell the power for.
Anybody else want to chime in here?
Hi, this is Baird Brown. I gather, in addition to the sound advice about reserves, that people have had problems because they had a single electric supply contract and then were subject to that being manipulated. Any transmission-dependent municipal utility or co-op would tend, if it's large enough, to have a portfolio of supply contracts, and which, you know, they may get for themselves or they may get some help assembling. But is anybody starting in the context of a community choice aggregation to act like more like a trader that's managing a portfolio of incoming assets?
Matthew, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, so that's basically the approach we're taking, and I think, you know, the trick for us is, you know, being a small entity that's, you know, basically a startup and, you know, not having a lot of capacity, we kind of approached it from, well, okay, how do we have the ability to do that without, you know, a major ramp up and you know the sort of technical base and the scale to make that really effective. And so, you know, again, we looked at what municipal utilities and a lot of the smaller entities often do is, you know, work through a shared, you know, service provider that can basically develop that kind of diverse, you know, portfolio with a number of counterparties right out of the gate through their existing capacity. And so, you know, we ended up with TEA, which serves about, I think, 50 or so municipal and public power agencies across the country. There's other organizations like ACES or the Northern California Power Agency that that do that kind of work on behalf of, you know, smaller public power entities. And so, you know, they're in the position where they can say, okay, we can put that kind of portfolio together instead of us having to kind of go out and, you know, negotiate, you know, a one-off agreement with, you know, one or two or maybe three suppliers initially. And so, you know, that was kind of to leapfrog that sort of initial step and build capacity. We said, well, let's find somebody that already knows how to do that and, you know, already has, you know, the trading desk and all that in place to be able to start out of the gate with that approach.
And I could just give a little bit more detail on these companies and organizations that Matthew mentioned. All of them are owned by public power, in fact. NCPA, the Northern California Power Agency, is a joint powers authority composed of a lot of the Northern California municipals. The Energy Authority, which is providing services to Humboldt, Matthew, is wholly owned by municipals up in the Pacific Northwest. And lastly, ACES, which is the Alliance for Cooperative Energy Services Power Marketing, is owned by nonprofit power cooperatives. So in all these instances, public power entities have over time pooled their resources to be able to provide better services at lower cost to all participating members. And that sort of program or model is increasingly being considered for implementation in the California community choice market. I haven't seen that in any of the other markets, though. Roger, I was wondering, is there any sort of legal or regulatory prohibition against collecting a reserve fund? In other words,
No, there's not. Okay. As far as I know, someone else may know better than I do, but I'm pretty sure NOPEC has been able to do that. They have a much larger history and a much larger organization. I think they do have that. In the first 2 years of SOPEC, though, our finances were so close to the bone that there was no possibility of that.
Okay. You know, in Massachusetts, it's actually local control for CCAs in terms of rate setting is partially constrained by the Department of Public Utilities there. So they are unable to justify to the DPU the collection of any sort of substantial reserve fund. Similarly, in New York, where the CCA regulations are still developing, the DPU wouldn't allow community choice programs to collect such a reserve, which really constrains program design options and ultimately the ability of the programs to achieve local policy goals.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments? Go ahead.
Well, here in Ohio, I have felt that we have been quite constrained in a number of dimensions. And whether we have that option, that could loosen things a little bit, but I'm a little envious hearing what California is able to do. There's much more latitude, it sounds to me, as well as support organizations that one could call upon. There are some interesting...
ACES and I think the Energy Authority as well are active in Ohio, or could offer services there. We could check.
Okay.
But, I mean, you mentioned really constrained market conditions as well, which doesn't help.
Yeah, I'm sure ACES would be. I mean, ACES is working in, you know, for the Southern Maryland Electric Cooperative, for example, in my experience. So,
is this Bear talking?
Yes, sorry.
Okay, yeah.
But is it limited to rural electric co-ops?
No.
No, it's not. That's just its foundation is with co-ops?
That's correct.
Okay. That's good to know.
Does anybody have any information about what's going on in some of these other states like Rhode Island? Illinois, I know it's kind of a disaster, but in New Jersey, they're looking into some of these things. Samuel, any thoughts on that?
No further thoughts on Illinois. I know in Massachusetts, the CCA market is ramping back up. I think there's something like 30 CCAs petitioning the DPU for approval. And I guess there's three areas of risk that I see there. Capacity pricing has just changed. So the seasonal pricing dynamics, which are can be pretty severe in the winter in New England, are going to shift, and that's going to be hard to anticipate. So for the model of CCA that is being deployed there, where they're locking in fixed prices for 1 to 3 years, that's going to be a risk factor for cost competitiveness. Secondly, some of the programs are increasingly engaging in what in California we consider to be greenwashing, which is buying system power and then claiming it's renewable or claiming it's greenhouse gas free through the use of low-cost unbundled renewable energy certificates, RECs, unbundled RECs. And there doesn't seem, in California, there's a lot of awareness in kind of the environmental and social justice activist communities about RECs and the difference in quality and the activities of CCAs. But I don't see that in Massachusetts or any of the other states. And then lastly, this is an issue that I'm still drilling down on, but in Illinois, the rapid expansion of community choice ended up severely compromising, you could say destroying, the renewables industry. And that happened because the way that they designed the RPS regime and the procurement authority was going through a state agency. Mark Pruitt could tell you about this. And they had somehow tied it to the number of bundled service customers or bundled service customer load. So as bundled service customers went to CCAs, the state, which had been engaging in long-term contracting for new solar and wind, lost its ability and appetite to engage in that contracting. Now, the problem in Massachusetts may be similar, and it's something I'm still researching. But if that's true, then it'll require a legislative fix.
Any thoughts about New Jersey, Rhode Island? Anything happening there?
I haven't really been tracking them. I think Rhode Island aggregation is limited to government facilities, or at least in practice, that's how it's played out. It's a fairly small state. And I don't know what's going on in New Jersey.
Baird, you were starting to say something. Do you want to continue with that? I kind of interrupted.
Not really. If very much was going on in New Jersey, I'd probably know about it. I'm often approaching things from the point of view of microgrids, and a lot of the community choice aggregation laws are set up so that you have to make an offer to everybody in your municipality or whatever jurisdiction or combination of jurisdictions you've got. And so it's not as good a vehicle as a plain old retail supply entity in a deregulated state for collecting a smaller geographic group to serve.
Any comments about that?
In California and New York, you're allowed to offer, in practice, CCAs have been offering distributed energy resource services to subsets of customers. There's been a lot of interest in microgrids in California, and in fact, Matthew, his organization received a grant to develop one. He can talk about that. In New York, Sierra had Glenn Weinberg present on the activities of their first CCA, Sustainable Westchester, and they received over 10 microgrid exploration grants from NYSERDA, though I don't think any of those are going on to the next stage of grant funding for development. Matthew, do you want to talk about your microgrid?
Yeah, and just to clarify, there was an initial grant that we were the lead on that kind of laid the groundwork, and then there was a second grant which we're not the recipient of, with some of our partners at Humboldt State University, were the recipients of, for sort of the second phase. It's putting in the control systems and some additional renewables. And so I guess, you know, to that end, you know, I think it's definitely a topic that we're interested in. You know, from a CCA perspective, you still need, you know, a partnership with the utility on the grid management side of it, you know, and their role in having a successful, you know, microgrid project. Obviously, if you've got kind of an existing ability to sort of island, a facility or a group of facilities, you know, in kind of a campus setting, then that becomes less critical if you just want to kind of have the ability to cut yourself off. But, you know, if you're kind of looking at something maybe a little more integrated, or if you're looking at kind of, you know, transitioning to having that sort of a campus-like setup, if you don't have that already, you know, we've been fortunate in that, you know, PG&E is very interested in this topic, and so they're receptive to the idea of looking at, you know, transitioning some of the infrastructure so that there is the ability to, you know, kind of give a little bit more control over where, you know, the authority to island kind of stops, as far as, you know, whether it's at a particular, you know, meter level or how that's integrated into to their operations. So, you know, I think as far as going forward, we're looking at, you know, that among other things, as far as kind of just our overall goals around local renewables, of saying, well, okay, how can we also look at, you know, energy security and reliability, you know, and critical facilities. And so that's definitely been identified as a priority. You know, I think how we'll kind of chisel away at that will, you know, first we want to just get the program up and running. And, you know, and I think as sort of a phase two, we'll be looking at, you know, how can we, you know, carve out a chunk of programmatic funding. And that's really the way we've been looking at, you know, as far as the first step of just saying, well, let's place off, you know, a percent or so of our overall budget for sort of program activities that support, whether it's, you know, microgrid efforts or electric vehicle charging infrastructure, those kinds of related activities that integrate with providing electricity service. So our board is kind of committed to saying, hey, if we can, you know, let's use a piece of our budget for those types of activities.
Yeah, so this is Baird again. It's exciting to
follow up. Go ahead.
I mean, it's exciting that you're taking the steps you're taking. I represent the Microgrid Resources Coalition, which is an advocacy group that's been joining in state public utility proceedings and FERC proceedings, mostly to try and level the regulatory playing field. And it's often not so level, but I think there is a lot of interesting room for utility private partnerships, or in this case, it would be a utility public partnership, you know, where the utility plays one role with its wires and you play the other role with the management of the electricity. So I think that's exciting stuff, but be interested to talk offline at some point.
I'll follow up on what Matthew was saying. At a high level, California is advancing various regulatory reforms, which are designed to integrate distributed energy into procurement, planning, procurement, and operational activities. And community choice programs are somewhat constrained in what they can do until those regulations develop. So, for example, at some point, Matthew, in running a community choice program, will be able to contract for various power products from DER assets like microgrids for local capacity and flexible capacity, for example. And that's really a pretty exciting area of development with community choice programs. What are those systems, and who are those experts that need to be hired to put in place essentially the business model and the operational capacity to effectively procure various distributed energy products and effectively integrate those into the operations and the portfolio planning and modeling and risk management strategies of community choice programs.
Yeah, well, we agree, and I guess there's a current new proceeding in front of the CPUC about third-party ownership of distributed energy, which we're very likely to join in and comment on.
The DRP and IDER proceedings?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the DERMS at the CAISO. And the DRAM.
Well, yeah, there's been a welter of proceedings, and I only just focused on the particular docket right now that seems to be one that we'll want to join in on. But we've joined in before on things like CalISO's efforts to allow aggregation of behind-the-meter assets to play in the wholesale market.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts or comments? No, go ahead.
Well, maybe I could, if there are no more questions, I could talk about what I'm doing down in Los Angeles.
Sure.
Okay. Any more questions before I get into that?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, so Los Angeles County is the largest municipal government in the country. In terms of load, even if you subtract out the five municipal utilities that are inside the county, it accounts for about a third of Southern California Edison's load. And at the same time, there's 84 eligible city governments and the county government that could form CCA programs. So the governance question that we're facing is how do we maintain an economy of scale in coordinating those programs while ensuring that we're not diluting democratic representation, or that, you know, for example, the goals of the program are dictated by the largest entities in terms of load. So I've been consulting proposed a governance strategy that's modeled off of NCPA and SCAPA, the Southern California Public Power Authority, both of which are joint powers authorities of municipal utilities. And so the proposal is to create a JPA of CCAs. So that each local CCA, which may be composed of, you know, 10, 15 cities at a time, would determine their own portfolio mix, control their rate setting, and all their finances, including their reserve fund and risk management policy. The regional kind of umbrella joint powers agency would be used kind of in a mechanistic way. So it wouldn't have any sort of policy mandate, but it would contract for and supply the services that are required to achieve the policy goals of its local CCA members, and would also manage opportunities for power pooling, joint build projects. And we think would accelerate the credit rating process that community choice programs need to be able to issue revenue bonds for projects. Right now, Marin Clean Energy is, I think, the only CCA that's seeking a credit rating, and they've been operating for 6 years. So it requires a track record and building up a reserve fund and all that before you get to that point. At the same time, the Los Angeles Community Choice Program is going to be designed to integrate distributed energy to a greater extent than any of the other current models we have operating in California. And that's also part of my scope of work as a consultant.
Any questions or comments?
Well, this is Roger back here in Ohio. It sounds to me like a lot of what you're talking about, I've been reading under the rubric of virtual power plants. And I wonder if that is a terminology you use, if those are supported under the California regulations. I'm trying to determine if it would be possible for a CCA to do a virtual power plant here in Ohio. And so I have a number of questions around that. But is that familiar terminology to you?
Yeah, I actually used to work for the consultancy that popularized the term about 8 years ago, KEMA, mm-hmm. Which was a European utility management consultancy later acquired by DNVGL. So a virtual power plant is a managed aggregation, typically of dispatchable distributed energy resources, both in America, it's considered to be an aggregation of both generation and demand management resources. In Europe, they tend to refer to generation only. Mm-hmm. In California, community choice programs can make use of them. Again, the ability to monetize the value that those create are constrained by regulation. And that's still evolving. But for example, Marin is piloting a couple of activities that could be considered virtual power plants. For example, with electric vehicle managed charging, they have revenue sharing agreements executed with E-Motor Works to be able to share the revenues based off of day-ahead market participation, as well as in PG&E's DRAM, demand response auction mechanism for capacity resources. No CCA has kind of designed their back and middle office in a holistic way to support virtual power plant activities. What Marin did was kind of launch with a single ESP and then begin to contract bilaterally to diversify their portfolio. Now they're about to transition to an independent schedule coordinator, Z Global, next year, while at the same time piloting virtual power plant capabilities with several different commercial counterparties. Actually, I have an interview call with their procurement manager later on today to discuss more of this.
It sounds like it's a good topic for another webinar, actually.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to wrap this up pretty soon here. No, Baird, is that you? Go ahead. A few more minutes.
Well, just to say that I think that it's... the opportunities to make a CCA into a complete plug-and-play option for DER are fascinating and exciting, and that would be a direction that would be great to see people moving in. There are, Sam probably knows them all too, but there are a lot of folks who would love to talk to you about developing a microgrid within your context, whatever that context is. And I certainly could make introductions to a bunch of them from the large to the small with some commentary on what their particular virtues are. if that's helpful.
Oh, great. Yeah, that would that'd be a good resource to develop and share within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find each other on the Municipal Sustainability and Energy website under mseforum.com and then look under CCA. So that's where you can find the contact information for the folks on this call.
Great, thanks.
Great.
Any other comments or thoughts? Okay. Well, we can wrap it up right now, and Samuel will be discussing this in detail on a webinar in January, and I can't remember the exact date, but we'll get this information out to you another week or so, probably after Christmas, when people are paying attention to it. So thanks, everybody, for coming, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Bye now.
Thanks to the presenters.
Yes, excellent job.
Hang on.